introduce myself in Navajo because it's kind of customary. So I'll start that and I'll just introduce myself in English after that. So, Yate, Shea, Dwayne Dale, Yunishia, Tachitni, Do, Tava, and Bushes Chin, Tortachitni, Adashache, Hashkadzo, Adashanelli. And basically, my name is Dwayne Dale Jr. I have four clans. And usually, for anybody who's listening who is Navajo, it's a cool way to see how we're related. That's why you kind of state your clans in the beginning of any, if you're speaking to anybody in a group. Yeah, Dwayne Dale from Shiprock, New Mexico, which is on the northwestern corner, well, northern part of the Navajo Nation. And my role is industrial designer and a footwear designer. And just, you know, happy to be here and talking with you.
Tell me about where you grew up and how you grew up.
So, it was on the Navajo Nation, which is Navajo Reservation. Growing up on any reservation, we don't realize that the word reservation doesn't have the same meaning as you get older. Then you start to realize, like, oh, okay, you see how those were formed. Like for example, early on, like in elementary age, you don't really realize that there's, you know, you're doing things that much different as far as a community. I was heavily involved in sports. So then the majority of the teams I played against were like non-native schools. And once you start to you get used to it, but once you start driving back and forth over the reservation borders, it starts to kind of hit you and you're like, oh, you're living in this, it's not like a different state. It's not a different county. It's like you're crossing over this invisible line that it separates you, right? Mm-hmm. So growing up in that way, I always felt like I was living in these two worlds, so to speak. I have the world of Navajo culture, Navajo traditions, and then you have everything else outside of it. So I always felt like I was kind of in the middle. It's like trying to survive and adapt to both sides because they were different. I grew up on a rural area. It was a high desert, you know, southwestern area of the United States. Kind of moved around when I was younger. But one of my bigger memories growing up was growing up on a farm, maybe 2 to 4 acres. But we grew everything from like alfalfa to corn, squash, watermelon, and everything was planted by hand. That was kind of some of the ways my parents and my grandparents raised money each year. I feel like it's really hard to explain outside of just growing up on a reservation. There are limitations to a lot of things. Sometimes, for example, like water, like housing was always a big thing. So there's always that, like, there's a blend of a lot of limitations, but then there's a blend of like, there's like freedom. There's like, there's hardly anybody around. You can kind of go where you want to go. If you drive literally 5 minutes outside of your town, you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere type of thing. You're like smack dab in the middle of a desert with, you know, mesas, plateaus, and all these kind of like cool surroundings. When I'm talking to like a local or a friend, you know, like, oh, we grew up on a reservation. But when we say that, it's like, oh, we understand what that means. I guess it would be like saying, you know, I grew up inner city in a bad neighborhood. Like, people get that kind of, people who've been there mm-hmm. would understand that. Growing up on the reservation is, it is different. It feels slower at times, which is nice, but also like slow enough to where you're really not up to, when I was living in Portland, right, things are happening so fast, Portland, Oregon, and that's just the total opposite, I guess, back home. The Navajo Nation is huge, but if you were to drive east and west of the Navajo Nation, that's like a solid 4 to 6 hours.
Wow.
Or 4 hours maybe. And then north and south might be like 3 hours. It's a big chunk of land. And on that land, there's a lot of small communities, some bigger communities. But like I was saying, they have usually one grocery store. So most of the time you're heading out to get stuff and bringing it in. In some parts, a lot of free roaming cows and like horses and stuff that are just, you know, they're out grazing, you know, it sounds liberating, I think, to a lot of people. But sometimes I just feel like, again, there are limitations that just me growing up and having the ability to do what I'm doing now, I always go back and like, man, you know, if more of this stuff was taught to if more of the kids can see what's happening, it's almost like their world just grows bigger.
What was it that you were interested at as a kid before you were kind of exposed to certain things?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. A lot of times it takes me back to growing up on the farm, because I feel like that's where I was really, I was pushed into this space where we didn't have electricity when we lived down at the farm. We would have water through a well system, I think. So it was interesting. Like, the water would be turned on by my dad outside, and then we'd take a bath and do all the normal stuff. But then it has to be shut off. Like, there wasn't just like constant, you couldn't turn the tap on, water would come out. We would still, like, I remember in third, fourth grade, I was still using oil lamps for like homework and stuff if I went late into the night. So I had to get stuff done early, you know, and do chores if my mom and dad had certain chores for us at that time. But really just being outside and kind of being like this dirty kid, really just getting involved with things. And that, I feel like that was, at that moment is when I just became kind of, never realized it, but fascinated with how things work. With whatever things we had there, I was, you know, involved in either taking apart, or I was doing a lot of drawing at one point. Didn't realize that the skill of drawing would kind of, When I grew up, the skill, like drawing, people who drew were just like artists, right? They were just people who drew these really cool pictures that usually hung up in like a museum or something like that. And I never realized that like the artist or the artistry part of like drawing, sketching, doodling actually has a place in the design world. That's actually a very valuable and useful language to, you know, get what's in your head out so people can see this. You just kind of, me growing up, I feel like I just learned to adapt a lot. And I think for me, like, adaptation was such a huge theme in like growing up that I kind of carried on through college and like up until now even. I feel like it's a constant, you're adapting to, whether it's the design space, the workspace, the, like, you know, like the company, or and it's so interesting that if you can't do it, either you're not meant for that job, or at the same time, I don't know how to explain it, but like adapting for me was like something, it was a tool that I was like, I wanted to keep. I wanted to be like, if you were to say, what's your biggest strength? One of your biggest strengths, I would be like adaptation, like adapting to a situation.
Tell me about when you left the reservation.
When I like left for a long period of time was for college.
Right. Okay.
You know, off and on, I was, again, being involved in sports, that allowed me to travel. I grew up playing baseball, and I grew up playing basketball and football. Okay. When I first left for a long time was for college. I got the opportunity to play baseball in North Dakota. And when that opportunity arose, I didn't want to turn it down, only because there are not many, back then there weren't a lot of people who left to play sports for college, let alone let that sport kind of pay for your college. But I know that was like leaving college was back in like 2003 when I graduated high school and went to undergrad, played baseball 4 years, finished that. It was in that space of like, I loved science. I loved like medicine. My drive was really going towards medicine. Like, I wanted to go into a sports medicine field and be involved with athletes and just kind of, I mean, that's kind of the world I grew up in. And if I can stay in it, I thought that would be awesome. So it was a small college. This one was in North Dakota again. It was called Valley City State University.
Okay.
Small college. It was a smaller college town, but for me, that was perfect. You know, okay. Being away from home was like, is tough for, I think, any college kid, but I think more so tough for some minorities, because you literally get dropped right in the middle of nobody looks like you. And that was the case for me when I went to college and just kind of go on a little bit from here. But when I went to college, I realized that I started to become the only person like me in every single class. And that's where that adapting was like, this is just kind of how it is. Mm. And so I expected that as I kept going from then on, like, forward. So it was a small college, and my next college was in Fargo, North Dakota. And it was North Dakota State University. That was where I did my graduate work. And then after that, I went to school again for industrial design in Portland, the Art Institute of Portland.
Did your family or did your community have any type of conversation with you before you left for college, kind of preparing you for being around people who weren't like you and being around so many people who weren't like you?
No, I think the way I was raised and the way I was kind of brought up was always you just treat people like you want to be treated. My community of people, they never really had, you know, those kind of conversations. For me, it was more joking, if anything. It was like, you're going to probably be the only dude from Navajo Nation, like, in that town, which was true.
So transitioning into being an industrial designer, what was, like, the most difficult part of transitioning, I'd say, academically from a sports medicine, like, academic background to industrial design classes?
The only difference is you're really not taught to think in a very linear path when you go into anything like design or like an art space. Really, the path to creation should be really driven by, I'm not trying to reduce swelling in an ankle, like a twisted ankle, right? So when you go in that path, it's you take these steps. When you're trying to design a new, you're providing a company a new design that they're trying to enter in a new category for footwear. I can't follow steps. There's not like you follow this recipe and you're gonna get this. It's more of, you gotta put yourself, for design, you really gotta put yourself in someone else's shoes every single time, right? I'm just going to throw something out there. If I'm going to design something for a tennis player, I want to know what they do. I want to know what their life is like. I want to know the workouts are like. So for me, the biggest difference is the empathy. Who is this person? And then like kind of how you kind of got to play a detective almost. Like, how can you become this person and kind of feel what this person's like to create this product for them? And that's the part I've always kind of liked about switching over, because then that opens up my world to, like, either, you know, you're shooting for the moon and then every concept becomes an answer to this small problem. Whereas going back to what I was talking about, there's a protocol. You ice, you do this, then you ice again, then you do this exercise.
Going into the work that you do now and Indigenous designer, and it might seem really obvious, but I really would love for you to talk about how you created that name and just what branding yourself and your skill set in design world has been like for you.
Right, that's cool. I'm kind of actually glad you asked that question. Not many people ask that question, because it Indigenous designer is like, it sounds like a description, which it is. But it all started back when I was finishing up my third industrial design program. Again, I was the only, in this industrial design program, was the only Native person, the only Navajo in this program. And I wanted to have this play on words where, like, me being an Indigenous person, but at the same time, like, I always felt like design or a designer was very much me from the beginning. And so it was like this Indigenous designer, like, play on words, means two, three different things. I vectorized my face. And there was this, at first it was a joke, because any designer, I think, is always like, if you get a tattoo of yourself, for example, your own face. If you do this of yourself, it is kind of, it's a little frowned upon in a way. But like for me, I felt like there wasn't many people like me that I met while in Portland. And I felt like, well, I just needed to like, you know, do something with like the way I look that needs to be like on there. Cause you could have Indigenous designer and not like it can be just the words itself are like, oh, that's cool. But I wanted to put like a face, a figure, an image that like kind of ties it in together.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, this person might be Indigenous. For one, I don't like when companies or really anybody starts to generalize what Native people look like. I mean, for me, I want to take that other approach. It's a more modern approach. It's more like in your face. It's a more Indigenous design. But when you look at my stuff, maybe there's some things I did that were like tied into these deeper stories of Native people. But at the same time, the design itself is kind of that the in your face style. It's
so you've like personalized it where it's not just like someone would see your designs or see your logo and be like, okay, Native person. They'd be like, oh, Dwayne, who is not
right. And like when they open up my website, you're not going to see like tribal print. When I designed product with the teams I was on, I was heavily involved in like innovation thinking and love that because, you know, I worked with some awesome people that that knew the value and importance of having people of different age, people of different race, people of different like just backgrounds and all walks of life come together. You work on a project and like that in itself right there creates an innovative, like it's an innovative process. But for me and how I grew up, just kind of how I explained it, I look at things differently. I look at how you did homework at night versus how I did homework at night. Like there's like, you know, there's just these different things that I feel like it leads people in a different direction, which is what I loved about kind of being in that innovative space. The answer and like the solution is always so cool. Like that's the fun part. That's one of the fun things I like about design and like pushing something that pushing something to some, like creating something no one's seen.
Speaking of that, can you talk about the fifth Rock Deep M1 Trail shoe?
That collaboration between myself and Rock Deep started back in June, July of 2020. You know, Rocky, who's the CEO of Rock Deep, reached out and pitched an idea. I said, hey, you know, you want to do a collaboration? I really like kind of the stuff I was doing. And it's funny because when he reached out, it was something that I was kind of wanting to work on. I was waiting to like work on it because it's why I got involved in the footwear industry in the first place. And no one's going to take you serious in the beginning. No one's going to be like, oh yeah, I think you have something like that. It might be in the movies, but at least for me growing up, like I realized early on that I'm going to have to work, whether it's where I come from or like what I look like or whatever, like I'm going to have to put in some work and adapt and like prove it. I've always wanted to design based on history, on early footwear. And I've seen other companies do it. You know, they try to bring out a moccasin sneaker, but there's something about it I just never like, it looked cool, but I was always like, why does it look cool? And I always knew why it looked cool because it came from one of the cultures, like these early cultures. But why, like, I don't want it. I don't have that desire to go out and like, I'm not going to buy a Visvim moccasin sneaker because the desire for me is like, it's not there. Like, I know, I don't know. I don't think there are any Native designers back there like pushing that envelope for them. So I wanted to flip the script and I want to be behind the scenes controlling all of that, you know, curating that that thing. So, I mean, you know, that's kind of where he went and he left, you know, the design direction totally up to me. And I was, you know, very appreciative of like him putting that faith. But it was fun because, you know, the way I saw it was I wanted to launch something that I'm not just taking from a culture. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to copy like a one for one what a moccasin looks like, but I want to take elements and celebrate those. Like, look, when you look at this M1 sneaker, look at the lacing system. It's very unique. And I wanted to, because when you look at moccasins early on, you go back, they were just looking for ways to keep it on your feet. Mm. So it would be wrapped in a certain way. And so that's, if you approach a product like that, I think it's cool because then you can visually like draw someone in and I'm like, wow, this is really crazy. You don't normally lace up a sneaker like this. But my thing as a designer is also it stays on your feet. That's my job, is to not just make it look crazy and cool, but I want it to stay on your feet. And so yeah, there's all of these things that I'm thinking about, or designers think about, my end consumer. I joke around, but it was like my family. When I say family, it's like all my relatives, all my other native brothers and sisters across the U.S. into Canada and Mexico, all the indigenous people that have a part in, they have a culture rich in footwear. This is people never really say, oh, you know, you guys have this really cool footwear, we want to bring you guys in to make it. No, it's like they'll take the picture, put it on an inspiration board, and like, this is what we want to do, and they'll go that way and without even like acknowledging where it's from. Growing up in a place where it's full of culture and it's rich in culture, that I didn't need to travel. I didn't need to get inspired by Japan culture, Paris, you know, anything like that. It was like, I just needed to go back and remember what it was that was really kind of fueling this drive to design footwear. And for me, it was early footwear. It was moccasins. It was and not to take away from the people that are making them by hand, but I felt like that was a product that could be elevated with modern techniques. Because if I don't do it, if people like me don't do it, everyone else is going to do it. But like, I don't want to buy everyone else's stuff. I want something that has a stronger story.
We were talking about before, like you being a designer, having empathy for the consumer, and then the consumer also having an appreciation for you, because it was like, it's almost like you have a relationship with the people that wear your shoes or purchase your shoes, because you did it yourself, right?
Right. It's really cool when people, when they share it, right? And they wear it, and it is like you have this relationship, and it's like you have, hopefully, and right now I think it was about 800 people bought it. So it's like you have these 800 plus relationships that they all understand what I'm trying to do. So now I just want to really create that experience when you first open it, when you put it on, when you touch it. Like there's all of these cool elements that that I feel like I can affect it if I'm really allowed to just express myself in that way.
My final question to you is, what is your favorite shoe or a shoe that kind of like changed your life? Oh. So you kind of answered those with the first two.
Well, the Jordan 3 was, but my favorite shoe, and this is me being like the most honest, my favorite shoe, the Nike Air Max 95 Uptempo, 95. And I can remember like the day that I saw them at Foot Locker. Like it was like, it, to me, I can like zone in on that moment I first saw it. And it was the first time that Nike was really putting like huge air bubbles around the whole thing. And to me, like I love simple upper patterns. So when Nike was in that phase of kind of a simple uppers and textures, that's kind of what got me.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be the 1995 Air Max Uptempo. It's like all white, black, like this black suede rand with these visible air bubbles that were like teal on the bottom. It was just like, that's what it was kind of got me, was those, that colorway.